That night, I feel a little better.
Feeling well enough to try some sugar smacks. Can't get enough of those sugar smacks, sugar smacks, sugar smacks. Can't get enough of those sugar smacks. I take them home for tea. So remember, all you cancer patients, when you're feeling awful, try sugar smacks. It's my food of choice.
But over the next few days, as the chemo destroys my immune system, I feel as rotten as I've ever felt. This is rock bottom. And without the energy that comes from blood cells, I feel fragile, anxious, and empty.
Well, it's January 21st. It's day one, i.e. I had my transplant yesterday. Is that right? Isn't it day two by now? Gosh, they're going slow. But I feel pretty crappy. I feel very nauseous. And my stomach is just very churny. Today, I ate what I was sure I could stomach, a piece of rye bread and some ginger ale, and I even threw that up. But I'd like to say, it was almost pleasant throwing up ginger ale. It's a lot better than throwing up some other things I could name, like orange juice. Blech.
There's some comfort in knowing that I'm supposed to feel this way. The chemo can't distinguish between healthy cells and the cancer, so it wipes out everything that grows fast, the lining of the digestive tract, the blood cells, hair follicles. One patient who's just been through it assures me it will pass.
I thought I was going to die 2 days ago, and now I feel like I said, as soon as you think it's never going to end, it does get better, so I know how you feel right now.
Dawn is a couple years older than me and has a 10-year-old. Looking at her is like looking in a mirror.
Well, and don't you find too that like every time you like see pictures of your son or whatever, doesn't that make you just even more determined to get better?
Yeah,
see, it does me too. Okay. Or if I see my daughter, it's it just makes me more determined.
Right, right. Yeah.
Just makes me more determined, you know. Every time I think, "Oh God, I feel so bad. I don't want this to, you know, I just don't want to go on." And I just think, oh, what's Jessica going to do without me, you know? And it's like, oh, I've got to kick myself in the seat and get with it.
Yeah, and I feel that way about the whole fight that, you know, I probably wouldn't fight half as hard except for Griffin. Well, what choice do you have, really?
You don't.
I think if my life maybe was different, I mean, if there wasn't Tom and Griffin, you know, maybe I would say, you know, I've lived and I've done things and I just don't want to fight this anymore. You know, I'm tired of it. You know, if you have to keep going through it and going through it. But you can't do that when you have a kid, or I don't feel like I can do that with a kid. I feel like I have to keep fighting, even though it's a pain in the butt.
Let me just cover when you sit forward.
No, I just feel a little shaky, you know. I'm not sure if it's real or just fear.
Though my recovery was supposed to be outpatient, 2 days after the transplant, I'm back in the hospital.
Well, it's day three, and I'm here because last night, at about 11 o'clock, I noticed that my heart was beating so fast that when I was laying on the bed, I just feel the big thump, 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 thump.
It was beating really fast, dun, 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 dun. And I counted like 150 or 160, and it was really, that was, her normal was 80. I said, okay, get dressed, let's go.
So we just kind of got out of bed and started to come in, and I sat down in a chair in the living room for a minute, but I must have fallen over, because the next thing I knew, I was like on the floor.
And then I heard a thud, and I came running out, and Beck was, you know, spread eagle on her back, just flat on her back, staring up. And I went and looked in her face, looked in her eyes. And she wasn't registering. I said, Beck, can you hear me? Beck. And she just didn't register me. Her eyes were blank. And I just scared shitless that something had really happened. Like she had a heart attack or stroke or something. And then within a couple seconds, she came back, and she was like, she registered me.
And then we walked out to the car, and then we drove pretty quickly to the hospital. And suddenly there are like a million nurses and PAs and internal medicine guys all in here, hooking me up to these monitors and seeing what was going on with my heart, and it was beating at like 190. But the thing that stopped it was they gave me this weird drug, which like they just put into your catheter and it makes your heart stop for like 3 seconds, and it was a weird, weird, an unpleasant feeling, kind of like an electrical feeling right after it, like electricity going through your body or something. And I felt really weird, and I still think I feel a little weird from that. But that got my heart rate down to like normal, you know, like to like 120.
Hi, just stop by to say the results of the echo, and I think you already know. There was no fluid around the heart. The valves are normal, the heart functioned normal.
And then by the end of the day, Dr. Tarantulo comes in, he's a great guy, a sweet guy, and he says, I don't know what the problem is. We may never know. Let's just hope it doesn't happen again. And that's where we've left it. And that's completely unsatisfying, you know.
So, they don't know, we don't know. They're not even going to treat it, really. I think I'd feel better if they sort of thought it was something and could treat it. So you always think medicine's going to be like that, like you'll find the answer and that'll be that. But a lot of times you just don't. We're no closer to knowing what the problem is than we started out, really, except that they think everything's okay. They think it's behind us and we're not really going to treat it. But I don't know why my heart was racing like that. It was scary.
That has stayed with me in a way that nothing else has, because it's like losing your innocence or something. I mean, it just seems like this weird thing. Like, my heart isn't supposed to ever stop, and my heart has been stopped. And to me, that represents some sort of loss of innocence, something that just should have never happened. And it sits badly with me. It's almost like everything else is okay, but that really gets me somehow. Like, I wish that hadn't happened.
So if we can treat this and get it under control, get the virus gone before your white cells return, then that's the best way to do it.
4 days after the transplant, and I'm about to go home to our apartment. I'm busy worrying about Tom having to give me antibiotic injections at home. Except I don't have to worry about that, because they tell me I have something called RSV.
So you won't be getting out of here today, unfortunately. We really need to treat this.
In like a week?
For a week.
The treatment requires I stay in the hospital isolation room for a week, and for 18 hours a day I have to wear this ridiculous-looking and very uncomfortable mask strapped to my face so I can breathe in an aerosol medicine. Here's something that people forget. It's not just physically grueling being sick. It's boring.
Well, it feels tight around my nose, and it feels sort of stuffy. And it just feels like it's hard sleeping because it's big, and, you know, I feel kind of like an elephant or something with this big nose. I can't eat with it on or do anything. I just feel like I have to stay very still. I mean, watching TV is good.
Would you like a cup of coffee?
What time is it?
Oh, about 1:30.
1:30? I must get dressed and go.
Why? What's your hurry? There's lots of time.
Oh, no, there isn't, and I've been quite enough trouble to you as it is.
Trouble? You're not what I'd call trouble.
That was just miserable because I had to be on this machine for 18 hours for 7 days. And I think my overall feeling about that was I was just embarrassed to be stuck in the, you know, with that thing on my face. I couldn't even believe it was happening to me. And also, I was mad. I was mad that they were doing this to me. At one point, you know, the doctor said to me, hey, we're not doing this to you to be mean. And he had to kind of remind me. And I mean, I knew that, but I was pissed that they were doing this to me. But that anger kept me from being worried or scared because their fear was that my lungs were going to clog up with this RSV virus and I would, you know, get something, I guess, sort of similar to pneumonia, or I wouldn't be able to breathe. Just down the hall, Graham has been on a respirator for more than a week. After Graham's 8-year-old daughter, Kelly, plays her flute for him, he seems to show some slight improvement. But the doctors say he's still in critical condition. It was a disconnect for me. I just didn't make the connection that there were all these other people on respirators and I could easily be one of them in a matter of days. I didn't think it was going to happen.
The big question that we're completely avoiding, and in fact I haven't even thought about until this point, really, is the cancer itself. We're in this, we're in the midst of this whole process right now, and you're so encumbered with the daily routine and sucking aerosol and getting your counts done, and so you're totally drawn into the process, and you're not really thinking about the final goal at all. The cancer, we know that it's there, we're here for that, but we're not thinking about that at all. I'm not, anyhow.
You did it. Yeah. Now it's just tidying things up. That's really a huge thing. Really big.
Finally, a piece of good news. Dr. Armitage, the head of the Omaha transplant program, drops by my room to tell me that the stem cells they transplanted into me are growing new cells.
Knowing that you have an adequate granulocyte count that you made yourself means you've engrafted, the marrow took. You're no longer at risk of sudden lethal infections. It means you've leaped over one other big barrier. And in fact, the truth is, usually from now on, things are downhill.
It was really nice and reassuring to have him say that, because we had had a sort of a small setback where I had had more chemo, and when we looked at the tests, that chemo hadn't done anything to shrink the tumor. And so you worry that the bone marrow transplant isn't even going to work. And he said, you know, really without any information, he said, I'm very pleased with how everything went. With this undertone of, you've probably made it, it's probably worked, you're probably okay. I don't know how he would have known that, or maybe he was bluffing, but it was real reassuring to have him come in and say those things.
And your blood counts are looking great. Wonderful platelets. I don't know if you saw them today.
Day 11. So they've just let me out of the hospital, and all of a sudden, it's over.
Liver testing,
just as sure as I was locked away, they're going to let me go.
What do you say about getting your catheter out and getting home? How's that sound?
Yeah.
Up for that? Congratulations.
Thank you.
We just need to give you a nice little certificate saying you're out of here. So, no, you did a great job.
It was weird to me when they said, okay, you can go home, and congratulations, yay, and everybody clapped and kissed and hugged.
Oh, I'm so thrilled for you.
Yeah.
Rebecca.
Oh, thanks for helping.
Mr. Trooper. Oh, hey.
So I was like, wait a second, you know, I haven't won anything here. Nothing, we don't know whether this worked. We know I got through this, but that's little consolation. You know, the really big prize here, the car, you know, the trip to Hawaii is, did the cancer go away? And we didn't know, and we weren't going to know for months. And so it was all very weird, everybody congratulating you and patting you on the back and saying good for you and, hey, it's all over now. And it seemed very strange to me.
You're a doll.
Thanks, Susan.
Take it easy.
We'll see you.
You bet. When you come back in 100 days.
Yeah.
Hey.
Bye.
Thank you. For the first couple weeks I was in Omaha, I felt like I was on an assembly line. You come in through a revolving door, you get on the line, you get your catheter, you get your stem cells removed, you get your high-dose chemo, you get your stem cells back. So now I was leaving, walking fast, head up. Suddenly I was the veteran, the old pro. And there was a scared old man with his family who had just arrived for his transplant, looking shaky and small as he sat huddled by the door.
You know, you don't feel too good, but, you know, at least it goes by pretty, you know, in a couple, you know, it's good as the white cells come back pretty fast. So, you know, just a matter of about 10 days there where you're really vulnerable.
Then we say goodbye to Lorraine.
How's Graham doing?
Her husband, Graham, is still on a respirator. She tells us that she's losing hope.
Starting to feel like it's not going to work. Sorry, I didn't want to
miss that. No, it's okay. Forget it, Lorraine.
I'm fine.
I tell her to be optimistic, but I don't know why I'm saying this. In my heart, I know she's right to prepare herself for Graham's death. It's not a good scene. Here I am leaving, getting out of town alive, and Lorraine's world is falling apart. I feel terrible for her, but mostly I want to get the hell out of here. I want to run. Still, I hug her and I tell her not to lose hope.
Well, that's pretty scary. That's pretty scary. But it's early for that still. It's early about for that.
I have a weird sense of this whole thing with Graham because, I mean, well, now it looks bad for Graham, but for a while there I was thinking it could be, you know, he could pull through and make it and the bone marrow transplant wouldn't really work for me and I could be down and he could be up, and I mean, nothing's guaranteed here at all.
Bye, Lorraine.
Okay, take care.
We'll call you.
Post this.
Yeah, we'll call you.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay.
Give Graham a kiss for us. Can you get in there to kiss him? Okay, then do.
Okay. Bye.
Griffy, you've gotten so big.
What?
I'm sorry I had to be away for so long. You know, I was away, but I'm back now. Are you my Griffy? Are you my Griffy?
I want to believe, and I think I basically do believe, that this whole ordeal did not impact Griffy in a bad way. And I think that it didn't.
Mommy.
Mommy came back. Mommy, they cried, they flapped, and they danced, and they bounced up and down on their branches. What's all the fuss, their mother owl said. You knew I'd come back. And the baby owls thought, because, you know, all owls think a lot. I knew it, said Sarah, and I knew it, said Percy. I love my mommy, said Bill.
Okay. Griffy.
Griffy.
Mommy.
Mommy.
Griffy.
Griffy.
Mommy.
Mommy.
Griffy.
Griffy.
Mommy.
Mommy.
And Mommy.
Mommy.
Hi, is this the 7th floor bone marrow transplant unit? I was trying to reach Lorraine Brazier. I'm a friend of hers, and I was on the unit myself, Rebecca Pearl, and I was just trying to find out about Graham. He's not in the room anymore.
February 3rd. I've been home 4 days when I call back to Omaha to see how Graham is doing.
This morning. Did they just take him off the respirator? They didn't. He just... He wasn't breathing. Oh gosh. So weird. I mean, this isn't what you expect, you know. I mean, it's rare that people die from the bone marrow transplant, but I guess it happens. But it's rare when you get your own cells. I don't know, I just feel sorry for Lorraine. Because she's got 2 little kids, you know. One is just 1 year old and one is 8 years old. And that's a lot, and it's just a lot that they won't have for father.
Springtime. The buds on the maple tree outside our bedroom window have begun to sprout, and so has my hair. I call this tree my hair tree because since I've been having chemo, my hair has fallen out and grown back at the same time the tree has lost its leaves and sprouted new ones.
Welcome to Omaha's Epley Airfield. The terminal curve is for the immediate loading and unloading of passengers.
April 15th. 3 months have gone by and we're back in Omaha. It's tax day, and the day I find out if my transplant worked. This time, we're only here for 2 days, and Griffin is with us.
Hello.
Oh,
who is this?
That's Griffin.
How you doing? Taking good care of Mom?
The news is good. Dr. Vose tells us the tumor has shrunk significantly.
CAT scan looked really good. They said that the mass was shrinking from what it was last time we checked it, and it was 2 by 1. That's pretty close to being what we consider normal size for a lymph node. So it's definitely a lot smaller. It's hard to know for sure if it's completely
gone. It's definitely not
smaller.
So.
A lot smaller. Uh-huh. A lot smaller.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well, you get all the
I think we got about as good news as we could. I mean, it could shrink a little bit more, I suppose, and it's possible that what we're seeing, the reason it's somewhat bigger than a regular lymph node is that there's scar tissue. So hopefully that's what it is, and we're okay. And so that's nice. It's good. This is the part where, you know, we do the Mary Tyler Moore, like take up hat and throw it up in the air. You know, we need that music, you know. You might just make it after all.
You might just make it.
It's funny when you realize you're going to get your life back, that your job isn't just fighting a disease anymore. Suddenly you have to live. Egad, you can't just sit around and wait to be better. You've got to go back to work or at least do something. Study biology. Write a book. That was very strange and difficult for me at first because for the past year and a half I'd been doing very little. Reading. Resting. Looking through catalogs. I was scared to go back to work. To face getting dressed every day, to be busy, on deadline, frantic, to let my orderly life and my time with Griffin get away from me. 1 year since my transplant. The tumor has shrunk to the size of a normal lymph node, suggesting the disease is gone. I'm back at work, but my energy is still low. I'm tired a lot, and when Griffin gets sick with a cold, I get sick too, and I get it bad. Still, we go on vacation. Tom and I went to Rome this fall. We see friends, make dinner. We even fight. And though my life is pretty good, I don't feel ecstatic, but I feel content. And if I worry, I worry about life returning to the way it was before I got sick. Sometimes I think, I wonder if it changed me. You know, like Armitage, who's the head doctor in Omaha, said, you know, you don't go through this without changing. And sometimes I feel like I'm really just the same, that I still sweat the little details or get mad if the kitchen is a mess or something, things that shouldn't matter to me anymore, having gone through something like this, and yet I still get caught up in them. And so sometimes I think, I haven't changed. And that scares me because it makes me think that if I haven't changed, then I do everything the same, then I could get sick again. But if I can learn from this and change, then I won't.
Scenes from a Transplant was produced by Dan Collison with help from Tom Jennings, to whom the story is dedicated.